from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Painter Richard Diebenkort created over 130 works of art during his stay in Berkeley, which was from 1953 to 1966, and there's a new exhibition at San Francisco's De Young Museum highlighting this period, which really helped cement his reputation as a key figure in post-war American art. We're going to talk with the curator in this segment of Forum, and I ought to mention, for those of you who are not familiar with Richard Diebenkort, he is very local in many ways. Grew up here in San Francisco and actually lived in Berkeley and Sausalito, went to UC Berkeley, Stanford, California School of Fine Arts. And this exhibit really focuses on the years, as I said, he spent in Berkeley. With us in studio is Timothy Bergert, the Edna Root Curator in charge of American art for the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. And what an exhibit it is. I mean, not only, of course, I've always been impressed with Diebenkort's work, but you almost find yourself, we were talking about how this sounds like a ridiculous analogy, we're talking about polarization in the first hour in the environmental scene, polarization in Egypt. You talk about polarization here, those who like representational art as opposed to those who like expressionistic art. And his whole metamorphosis really was an oscillation between the two.
You're absolutely right. And indeed, the appearance and the history of Richard Diebenkorn has been one that seems to be almost bifurcated into a split personality, as it were, that indeed 1953 to 1955 are these extraordinarily beautiful abstract expressionist works that really rank him with the first generation of abstract expressionists, even though he's slightly younger. He comes right out of the gate with these extraordinarily accomplished paintings. And then, very radically and very dramatically, late in 1955, he switches completely to figuration. And these works, of course, are therefore always seen, partly because it was so controversial, this switch at the time, to be as if they were created by another artist altogether. But in fact, the main thesis of the exhibition, as you suggest, is that there's much more common ground between them, and indeed that Diebenkorn deserves a lot of credit for being one of the few people with the courage to sort of bridge those seemingly unbridgeable gaps or schools. And indeed, in that era, which was really not coincidentally the Cold War era, a lot of art and artists were sort of enlisted as foot soldiers for these battles, as you say, between representation and abstraction, between Europe and America, or even between the New York School and the San Francisco School.
I went to the exhibit with my two siblings, and we found ourselves, my sister's lives in Cleveland, but she's kind of an art maven, and she said, much prefer the abstract expressionism here, you know, the expressionistic painting. I said, well, but look at all this representational art. And Diebenkorn was a tradition, he even called himself a traditional painter.
He did. He said, I'm not avant-garde at all. I'm actually quite traditional. I wanted to follow a tradition and extend it. And he has a wonderful quote about this where he says, you know, of course, it's absolutely true that in the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of avant-garde artists, Matisse, Picasso, Cezanne, artists who were his heroes, had to sort of push aside or even kick to the curb some of the very hoary traditional values of academic Beaux-Arts tradition. But he said, but in the process, they made the mistake, some of the critics especially, of also pushing aside things of great value. And so his goal was to reunite and reunify and sort of bridge that gap we were talking about and sort of keep the best of the past and the tradition and all the way back through the Renaissance. And then, of course, push art forward into a new kind of synthesis that would be relevant to contemporary post-World War II viewers.
Well, you do see the influence of Matisse. In fact, we have put a bunch of these paintings on display on our website. You can just go to it and see them at kqed.org. But there's this yellow collage he did, which is really a kind of a paperwork. It's right out of Matisse.
Matisse is his great hero. I would say Matisse and Cézanne are the two great historical figures. De Kooning is his great contemporary hero. And he had a wonderful connection. You mentioned his Bay Area roots. He's such part and parcel of the Bay Area's cultural and physical landscape. And while he was still at Stanford from 1940 to 43, his professor took him to Sarah Stein's house. And we all had the great Stein exhibitions just a couple of years ago. And he got to see some of the greatest works by Matisse, Cézanne, and Picasso right here in Palo Alto. And he said, that was really it for me. It changed his life. Matisse really became his sort of artistic lodestar, as it were, his sort of talisman. And you're right, these late collages really resemble the kind of cut papier-collé, painted, pasted, colored collages that Matisse did towards the end of his life. The great impetus here was a trip to Russia in 1964, one of the first Westerners in decades who actually saw the great Matisses in the Hermitage and the Pushkin, and they pulled them out of storage. Some of them were even flaking, he said. They were so badly mistreated. But this was a great revelation for him to see these works in person.
You can also see a lot of influence of Cézanne and a lot of influence of Rothko and, for that matter, de Kooning. I'm wondering, though, but nevertheless, an original painter, to be sure, when we talk about influences. But let's talk about really what he painted. I mean, the book, Richard Diebenkorn, which I love the copy of it, and you did most of the writing in it. In fact, did you know?
I was one of the authors.
Yeah.
Emma Ecker in our American Art Department and Steve Nash were the co-authors.
And you have a foreword by Dee Dee Wilsey, no less. But also, you pretty much divide things. It's interesting to categorize them in this way. The book divides things into landscapes, figure painting, and still lifes. And that really encompasses a lot of his career.
It's true. He talked about those being essentially his three favored subjects, landscape, figures, and still lifes. That being said, and then, of course, he said there are two ways of creating them or depicting them, which would be abstract and representational. That being said, when you look at the work carefully, you see there's great crossover. And indeed, for example, although we might assume that landscapes and still lifes are inherently non-figurative, in fact, what we found in researching the exhibition and looking closely at the artworks is that that is not always the case. I argue there actually is a painting, Berkeley Number 3, which at first glance is certainly a landscape by all sort of association, the colors, the palette, the stratification, and so forth. And yet, indeed, there may be a figure embodied within it.
I think you can see that on our website. In fact, it's there with a number of other Diebenkorn paintings.
That's wonderful. Yeah, well, and what you get from that, of course, is in this era that would allow ne'er the twain shall meet between abstraction and figuration, he's creating what is clearly an abstract expressionist painting, but by sort of sublimating this female nude figure within the painting, thereby endows the painting with a kind of potency and power and fertility and even sexuality that that figure inherently brings to a work of art. And so it's a wonderful metaphor for this fusion of nature, culture, figure, landscape in the most powerful and potent way.
It's what we would call hybridized painting. Almost.
Exactly.
Timothy Burgard with us here in studio, Edna Root, curator in charge of American art for the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. And the exhibition, by the way, Richard Diebenkorn, The Berkeley Years, will run through the 29th of September. Also want to give you an opportunity to join. If you've seen the exhibit or if you have questions about Diebenkorn or if you are a Diebenkorn fan or would like to bring your own voice into this conversation, let me tell you how you can do that. You can join us toll-free right now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls with any questions or comments you might have. And again, there are 130 works of art that were done during his stay in Berkeley from 53 to 66, and you can really see Berkeley in many of these, although he never had a Bayview. He had a number of studios there, but never really a Bayview, did he?
It's absolutely true. The question always comes up, if he numbered them and titled them Berkeley 1, 2, 3, and so forth, what do they really have to do with Berkeley? And do they, in fact, depict landscapes? And as you say, none of the four studios he owned in Berkeley, and one of which he built in his own backyard, had an expansive view of the bay. All of his work, even the representational works on a fundamental level, are actually abstract because even the representational works were drawn entirely from his imagination. He almost never stood in plein air out in front of the subject and painted it from life. They really are about his own imagination. He had a wonderful quote where he made a distinction between his environment, which would be Berkeley in this case, and his sense of place. And he said, my sense of place is about pictures and subjects. So when Diebenkorn enters his own landscape, it really is his landscape. It's a landscape of the imagination. And there's a painting he titled Inscape that really suggests it is about this interior life of the artist's mind.
Well, in fact, you were talking before about things that influenced him. I guess when he was in Albuquerque, he really sort of, sounds almost cliche, but true, he got in touch with his emotions to a great degree, and that involved a great ignition of his imagination. I want to give opportunity to listeners to hear Diebenkorn, actually, but before we do that again, I'd like to get your thoughts, those of you who are listening, if you are particularly interested in Diebenkorn, and to what degree you are, if you saw this exhibit, or even if you didn't see the exhibit, to what degree you are drawn to, let's say, expressionism or to representational art, or do you see more excitement in your own vision between a merger of the two. That's part of the whole debate here, if it is indeed a debate, but also get some reaction to you and any questions or comments you might have. And again, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. And also email us, forum at kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. And you can also, of course, go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I thought we'd hear a bit of Richard Diebenkorn. Here he is in a 1977 interview that was recorded on how he begins a painting.
Well, I think I have to violate the canvas in some way or other. Sometimes they're just too pristine looking and too kind of perfect to do anything on. But when they get a bit besmirched, well, then they're fair game. It's a very complex activity, believe me. And I don't enjoy it all the time. When I do enjoy it, it's marvelous. But there are times when somehow the inertia won't is very resistant, and I can't get things going, or they get going sort of, and go slowly and badly, and this isn't fun really. But then my hope is that I can kind of get things into just that relationship where some kind of continuity materializes. Very often, if you go to the locale where an artist works, you'll suddenly really know that you're in this person's area. Like if you go to Arles, or you feel the Van Gogh around you. You go to the hill towns and go to Siena and or Florence, and you get this suddenly. You're seeing Piero or whomsoever.
Well, there again, I thought it was important to hear Diebenkorn himself talking about how he violates a canvas and what he does to besmirch a canvas and all that, but just the importance of place that comes across in that. We're talking with Timothy Burgard, who is curator in charge of American art for the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, and the exhibition Richard Diebenkorn, that Berkeley Years will run until the 29th of September. I think it's also important, Tim, for listeners to realize how in 1955, when he was at the height of this abstract success, he really kind of shocked the art world, didn't he, with this dramatic shift to representation?
He absolutely did. It was shocking to people. He was a rising star. He'd had his first exhibition in New York City, which was very well reviewed, and to suddenly seem to make a complete break, just as his friend and teacher David Park had sooner, was really, really seemed beyond the pale. He said one collector called him up and called him a traitor and said, "You've ruined the value of my paintings." And he really rejected any sense of commercial concerns, critical concerns. I give him a lot of credit for consistently following his own inner vision and really rejecting the kind of art world politics that weighed so heavily upon artists of that period. When you interview them today, even today, 50, 60 years later, they still speak of the friendships broken, the resignations from the Art Institute, the sort of take-no-prisoners attitude of an artist like Clifford Still, who taught there at the California School of Fine Arts. You were either an apostate or you were an acolyte, and there was no middle ground. Diebenkorn, to his credit and with great courage, really followed his own vision.
And we heard his voice, but we should also mention that there are notes that he wrote to himself as you enter into this exhibit, which are kind of interesting. Attempt what is not certain, tolerate chaos. And he's almost on aphoristic. They are aphoristic. Be careful only in a perverse way. let's bring our callers into this. By the way, we should also mention that there is, again, the sense of place here that's so important to emphasize, and Berkeley itself. Wasn't it Rothko who remarked that San Francisco landscapes are, I think he said, just, I want to get the quote right.
Unspeakably beautiful.
Unspeakably beautiful. That's what he meant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was looking for that word, unspeakably. And you can certainly deduce that Diebenkorn felt the same way.
He did, and I think Diebenkorn's great revelation, which you referenced earlier, occurred in Albuquerque in the 2 years prior to arriving in Berkeley, was he said, you know, I kept keeping blue and other landscape associative colors off my palette, and finally in Albuquerque I let them in. And he let them into his work, and they had those associations, and he decided he would let the work of art be consummate with his own feelings. And so this is the great insight of the Berkeley years, is indeed that the Berkeley landscape, the meeting of earth, water, and sky that we all experience every day was really something so fundamental to human experience. But he realized that the landscape, so to speak, or the field of his painting, could be a field for the projection and expression and embodiment of his own emotions and feelings. And this is the key to understanding Diebenkorn, whether they're abstract or whether they're figurative.
Well, there's another key, and it comes through in the book that you and your co-authors have put out. You talk about whether it's abstract or whether it's representational, the light, the harmony, and the vivid color.
It's absolutely true. Diebenkorn is one of the great colorists of his generation. You mentioned Mark Rothko, who taught at the California School of Fine Arts while he was a student there. And this is that sensibility and that sensitivity for light, color, atmosphere. We live in one of the greatest chromatic landscapes in the world. Every day we have the sort of influx of the fog and the sort of mystifying effects of the fog and the light and the color and the atmospherics. Diebenkorn was so sensitive. One of his best friends said, if Diebenkorn moves down the block, it changes everything. He absorbed the aura of a place.
In fact, a listener named Norman writes, I think his sense of place is articulated by colors of which he is a master, so beautiful, so rich. And it really is striking how much he has not only influenced, and you see it in the Berkeley years, the way we see the Bay Area and particularly Berkeley itself, but also his influence on post-war American art. It's very difficult to understate that. Let me bring our callers into this, and we begin with Paige or man, I'm sorry. Which is it, Paige or man? Paige.
Hello, I'm
yes.
on.
You're on.
Yes, I'm on. I just had a little interesting story about Dick Diebenkorn and the artists of... In 1954, may have been late 53, I think it was 54, David Park set up a little life class in Dick Diebenkorn's studio. They met once a week. And the Dick and David and Elmer Bischoff were pretty much always there, and some other people, Wally Hendricks was at least there occasionally. And they do like super fast sketches of a model. And I was the first model because my father was a close friend of David's. I was a pretty close friend of David's too. I think it was in the 11th grade when this happened. Eventually they worked their way up to actually paying professionals.
You're part of history, Paige.
Yeah, I'm part of history. Well, I'm in Nancy Boas's David book a bunch. And I used to have one of
them. Now you're in our archives. You're here to stay, yeah. I appreciate your call. Thank you. That's a little historical note here. Let me get another caller on. From Davis, Jerry joins us. Jerry, hi. I'm sorry.
Hi, Jerry DeCamp. I'm a painter, and I've always been a big fan of Diebenkorn. And I can't quite figure out. I had a lot of stuff in art history, but there's something about Diebenkorn that's so gigantic to me that seems so much bigger than most other painters, with the exception of people like Matisse and Picasso. And I'm just wondering the curator's sense of this question about Diebenkorn's monumentality. I can't quite answer it, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
I don't know if I can answer it either, but I will try. He certainly is a towering figure in every sense. He is one of the most influential post-war American artists. And as Michael said, he's really defined the way we perceive the world around us, in particular the Bay Area landscape, but even figures situated within that landscape. I think one of his great contributions is to take subjects, often still lifes, interiors, figures, that seem to be the most prosaic, or perhaps even the landscape around us, very beautiful, no doubt, and no question, nonetheless seem to be only landscape, so to speak, and not to have any kind of story or narrative. Diebenkorn's great contribution, I think, is to transform the prosaic into the poetic, and to find the universal qualities and human interactions, the solitary figure in a room, the man and woman, the couple in a room, and the kind of psychological, emotional, and physical tension or expression they might have. We can see ourselves in his paintings. If it's a landscape, we project ourselves into the landscape. If it's a human narrative or story or figure, we connect with those figures. And so I think, like Picasso, Matisse, Cézanne, the artists he admired so much, it's the ability to take the prosaic into the poetic and onto the universal that is really the ultimate sign of a truly great artist.
And if you see this great artist, Stephen Korn, and his Berkeley years at the museum, I ought to add that there's a kind of twofer in this. You get to see the photography of Rose Mandel, who was a close associate and friend of Stephen Korn's, and who I had never seen her work at all before. I was quite impressed by it, I must tell you.
It is marvelous, and the most astounding sequence of photographs is a series of Stephen Korn in the Berkeley studio that he constructed in his backyard, painting a work called Woman by the Ocean from 1956. And if you follow the sort of time-lapse sequential photographs of him working, you see him start with a painting of a man seated half-length in the lower right of the canvas with a hillside and hilly landscape behind him, and then he turns the painting upside down, and it is completely repainted and transformed into a three-quarter length of a woman seated at the lower left. This is all part and parcel of Stephen Korn's working process. It is very much about process, not product. In the organic evolution of the canvas, he works out and carries out his physical and psychological passage and trace and across the surface of the canvas. What we are left with, what remains, as it were, is this penultimate statement that is never completely finished. There's a wonderful Wayne Thiebaud comment. He said, they're always complete, but they're never finished.
They were friends, too. In fact, there's a painting there from the Thiebaud collection, from his own personal collection. Kit from Palo Alto writes, as your show came on, I was working on the Stephen Korn puzzle I bought at the exhibit, Seawall, which is, by the way, up there on our website. At the exhibit, I realized that his transition from abstracts to landscapes seemed very natural, as the abstracts are full of planes that look like horizons. The people in the portraiture seem to me more like part of the landscapes than a change away from them.
That is a very astute observation, and the way that I have phrased it is that the ostensibly abstract expressionist works often seem to have figurative elements lurking underneath them, beneath the surface, as it were, that
like
might come out.
Like your unconscious or your subliminal world.
Absolutely. And that they gain that kind of strength from that sublimation. By opposition, or arguably even a continuity, a continuum, in the figurative works, he often uses geometric abstract elements, often doors or windows or a horizon line, the sort of tripartite division of the landscape, to sort of temper or augment the psychological narrative that takes place in the figurative painting. So that is absolutely correct. He saw it as a continuum, not as a break.
Another listener, Eric, writes, one of the things I think is so unique in Stephen Korn's work is his comfort with figuration and abstraction. He achieved greatness in both. I live in Berkeley, and his work shapes my sense of my surroundings in so many ways. A brilliant artist. Let me bring another caller on here, and that's a caller from Berkeley. Bart, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for doing this show, Michael. You've mentioned a couple of times that Stephen Korn did 130 works of art in the Berkeley period, but he must have done many, many more. It's just 130 in the show, right?
Yeah, there are 130 in the show. If I made it seem like there were only 130, that was not certainly not my intention. And in the book that's out, by the way, you can get, I think, all of them, can't you, Tim?
Many of the most important works are in the exhibition catalog.
What I wanted to ask Tim was, I know from the Stephen Korn Foundation that he did something like 5,000 works that they can document, and maybe 4,000 works are on paper.
Well, he was doing paintings every couple of weeks just about when he was in Berkeley, wasn't he?
So that's absolutely right.
I'm wondering how you people, like professionals, regard his works on paper in relationship to his whole, to his whole body of work.
I would say that Stephen Korn is one of the greatest draftsmen of the post-war period in any country. The drawings are one of the great revelations of the exhibition. They're less often seen because, of course, they're inherently light sensitive. So it is extraordinary to have so many in this exhibition. They are astonishingly beautiful. And one of the things I especially love about them are the figure studies, often from the nude models that a caller mentioned earlier. Park, Bischoff, Stephen Korn, Lobdell did have these weekly drawing sessions where they would hire a nude model. And in them, you often see this extraordinary accumulation and accretion of lines. so that the female seated figure seems to have three arms or four legs that have shifted position over time. So rather than the Beaux-Arts sort of academic tradition of making the perfect neoclassical drawing, what you have is a post-war image that's more in keeping with an existential sense of our own human condition, where everything is contingent, nothing is fixed or final, but everything seems to be alive with a kind of organic vitality. And that if you turned your back even for a moment, the physical and emotional forces that have been set in motion by Diebenkorn might continue to evolve.
We thank you, Bart, for the call. I was also struck in reading your book, we're talking about his roots out here. He had an exhibit at the Palace of Legion of Honor. This is not the same Palace of Legion of Honor now, but in the summer of 1948, he was only 26 years old, and this was a solo exhibit.
That's absolutely true. Everyone at the California School of Fine Arts knew that he was a rising star in the art world. Douglas McKagey was a director of the then the Art Institute, and of course, Jermaine McKagey was at the Legion of Honor. He was given this great honor, which of course turned out to be very prescient of the Fine Arts Museums to give this young artist an exhibition. It was fully borne out, obviously, by his subsequent career. What's also interesting is we have history there even earlier. The 15-year-old Richard Diebenkorn went to his first major art exhibition at the Legion of Honor, and it was the first Van Gogh retrospective in America. And he never forgot it because he watched a tour group going through laughing at the Van Goghs, and that these were not art. They were the sort of scrapings and paintings of a madman. And then he said within 10 years, every one of those Van Goghs was iconic and reproduced to ad infinitum.
Bring another caller on, and that's you, Seinu. Good morning.
Going to say I went to see the earlier Diebenkorn. I think it was at the MoMA a few years ago.
There was a retrospective.
Yeah.
Yes, and I haven't seen the new one yet. But I went in naively. I wasn't a fan. I didn't know what I was getting into. And my very first reaction was almost anger. I was like, I do not know how to look at this. And then I just gave it a moment and opened up to it. And like you've been saying, it was that each painting struck me as this incredibly beautiful composition with this color and emotion to it. And it was one of the most enchanted, it was the time I was most enchanted by a museum visit ever. And yeah, it was a Diebenkorn retrospective. So everybody should go.
Yeah, well, thank you. In fact, we're getting those kind of testaments here about the exhibit that we're talking about. Kathy writes, I was brought to tears viewing Diebenkorn in the Berkeley years. Such rich color, marvelous layers, scale, inventiveness. No single artist has influenced me more. As an art major in the 60s, there were many new faces in the art world. Jasper Johns, Wayne Thiebaud, the whole pop art movement. Yet it was Diebenkorn who moved me the most and still does. And Joyce writes, as an oil painter myself, I'd like to thank you so much for the show. I'm a huge Diebenkorn fan also of your program. Thank you, Joyce. And go see it. I mean, even if you know nothing about Diebenkorn and little about art, I would urge you to see it. All the more reason, perhaps, to see it. Final word from you, Tim.
I wanted to read a quote from Alfred Frankenstein, the legendary Bay Area art critic, echoing the last caller's views. This is 1950. He wrote, as is often the case with workers in this style, I found myself repelled at first by the apparently haphazard improvisation, the vast pretentious size of their canvases, and their reliance upon runs and drippings that remain for good in the department of the accidental. After a time, however, it seemed to me that these works communicated a fabulous richness and energy that they took one into a new domain of visual expression that could be entered by no other road, and that what they had to say was at least as important and at best profound.
Richard Diebenkorn, the Berkeley years were one until the 29th of September. Tim Berger, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Amanda Stupai. Engineer is Danny Bringer, executive producer, Raul Ramirez.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.